Hey friends, it's me again. You know what's really easy to do and even easier to forget? Help me out and hit that like button if you're listening on YouTube. If you're listening somewhere else, what the hell? Pop in and give me a thumb. Say hi while you're at it. Helps me a ton with that damn algorithm. And besides, it's always nice to see you there. All right then, let's hop on that crazy train.
All aboard!
Well, hey there, friend. Looks like we made it through February, huh? Yes, sir. Just about time to put the snowblower back in the shed and hang up those shovels. Or is it? Well, I know that, Chester, but you gotta understand. I've got like 20,000 Midwestern women listening. It's cold up there. Just trying to relate. Yeah, it's like 90 degrees here in Texas already. Come down and sun your buns, ladies. But for now, let's head on inside, y'all. We've got some work to do. All right. Well, check out simplyscarypodcast.com and become a patron. For as little as $7.99 a month, you get the entire catalog ad-free and available to download or stream. It helps keep the channel from going belly up, so you can always feel good about that. Of course, there's also patreon.com/DrewBlood if you're feeling really generous. That's where you get the Drew, Jeff, and Paul show. We have a good time over there, y'all. Stop on by sometime. Anyway, tonight we welcome back author Ambrose Ibsen by way of our friends at Velox Books. This story comes from his brand new collection, What Gathers at Dusk. In this one, we recount the tale of a few boys who come across a mysterious abandoned bunker in the woods. So without further delay, y'all, from author Ambrose Ibsen, I give you, It Waits Along the Left-Hand Path. Do you remember what it's like being a kid? Were you wild and free or cloistered? My childhood fell into the first category. There were days when I'd step out the front door after breakfast, and I wouldn't come home until the cars on the lonesome country roads were putting on their headlights. Out there, in the fields and woods, I got stung by just about every critter that's got a stinger. Popping willies on my back, I busted my knees more times than I can count. You can still see the scars. I almost drowned while fishing for bluegill in the creek after a few days of heavy rain. Twice. I can look back at the bumps and the bruises, the scares, and laugh about it all now. Compared to a lot of kids today, sheltered and screen addicted, my childhood looks like something out of the movies. A lot of little ones today have never seen a firefly, much less caught a jarful on a summer's night as I used to do. I like to think that the adventures of my childhood built a lot of character, that they made me more resilient, more imaginative maybe. But of course, there are times when I look back on it all and wish my folks had been a little more restrictive. The older I get, the more I wish someone had kept a closer eye on me, denied me some of that freedom. Had they done so, I wouldn't have been there that summer evening by the old bunker. I wouldn't have been there the day that Jonah went missing. Picture, if you will, a vast, vast sea of knee-high grass. Now throw a few clusters of woods into the mix here and there, whatever you like. Oaks, jack pines, box elders, we had them all. Still with me? Imagine a few streams, ponds, and lakes spread out across this scenery, and long winding roads throughout it that don't see a whole lot of traffic. Now you have in your mind a pretty accurate illustration of the place I grew up. Sure, there were some other bits and bobs, a steel mill where fully half the town's men worked, and some of the women too. A single school building answered for grades K through 12 and looked like a prison, with a tall wire fence around its perimeter. We had the quaintest big box store you'd ever seen in your life, and a few restaurants that catered mainly to truckers. The houses all looked tired, even back then. Not broken down, not particularly dirty or messy, but like they'd had the wind knocked out of them. They tend to sit on generous lots. You might have to walk a few minutes to visit your nearest neighbor. For kids, bikes were a must. There was just too much ground to cover. We'd pedal back and forth to school in flocks, taking the things along the shoulders of country roads while begging guys in big rigs to blast their horns. Most of us didn't have nice bikes. I myself piloted what cast-offs I could find at garage sales and kept them in working order with elbow grease. Jonah, though, had a really nice bike. The day his dad brought it home from the shop, a silver Schwinn, he went blasting around town and drew the eye of every kid for miles. He was a quiet one, a little tall for his age, with sandy brown hair and oversized ears. His mother had passed on shortly after giving birth to him, and he lived with his dad, a manager at the steel mill on my street, just three houses down. Growing up in the days before video games and the internet, we had to make our own fun. And for a bunch of bored kids, that usually involved fist fighting or unnecessary drama. Unlike most of us, Jonah was never one for those sorts of things. Cool-headed, he didn't get involved in the neighborhood spats and was well-liked by pretty much everyone. He was always willing to join the rest of us in exploring town, looking for something interesting to do. But at the first whiff of trouble, he had no qualms about striking out on his own and entertaining himself. I think that's how he happened to find the bunker one day. It doesn't matter how hard I look, what terms I use to search. I can't find anything official about the abandoned underground bunker. Believe me, I've tried just about everything I can think of. But even the older folks in town simply shrug their shoulders when the topic gets brought up. It's as though the structure has always been out there, waiting in the overgrown earth, its entrance shadowed by old-growth trees. The best guess I or anyone else can come up with is that it was built during the Second World War. Some paranoiac with money, maybe, used to own the acreage in question and spent a pretty penny building a labyrinthine bunker underground to protect himself from potential air raids. Some have theorized, and I don't fully discount the notion, that the bunkers are a throwback to the Cold War era, built by the government in case of Russian nukes. A more benign idea that sometimes gets thrown around is that it isn't an underground bunker at all, but a foundation for a long-abandoned factory or other commercial venture that never got off the ground. Seems plausible enough. Whatever it is, none of us kids were really aware of its existence until the day that Jonah rode out on his own and went wandering through the woods north of town. To hear him tell it, he'd been on the lookout for frogs when he had discovered what looked like a large metal pipe sticking out of the forest floor, curved like the top of a candy cane and thoroughly rusted. He'd kicked at the thing and tried looking into it, finding only darkness and the scent of damp. As one does, he'd gone on to throw a bunch of pebbles and sticks into it in an effort to gauge the pipe's depth and had found it to run quite deep. The next afternoon after school, Jonah rounded all of us up and announced his find.
"Yesterday in the woods up north, I found something really weird. There are pipes sticking up out of the ground, and I think they lead to something."
I remember one of the other boys commenting,
"Might be a gas pipe. Careful around those. You might blow something up."
"No,"
insisted Jonah.
"This wasn't no gas pipe. I dropped something in, and I could hear it hit solid ground after a bit. I think there's something underground, beneath the pipes. A room, maybe."
Needless to say, this assertion caused quite a stir among us, and we didn't need any further convincing to explore that patch of woods. Arguing amongst ourselves, some taking Jonah's side and others sure that he was making it all up, we flew on our bikes and traced the route he had taken the previous afternoon. Abandoning our rides on the grassy shoulder by the road, we went stomping into the woods. It wasn't long before we discovered the first curved pipe. It was thick, growing out of the earth like some kind of rusted pitcher plant, its flared edges flaking away and its mouth filled with darkness. Like Jonah had done, we all took turns feeding stones and other junk into the pipe, attempting to sound its depths. Wandering a little deeper in, one of the kids discovered another pipe. Same size, shape, and condition as the other one. A third turned up shortly thereafter. I think we found 5 in total before we wandered far enough into the woods to happen upon something far more interesting. Nestled in a little ridge, sheltered by shaggy pines and mounds of overgrowth, we found what looked to be a concrete doorway or tunnel set into the earth. When we first set eyes on it, I remember we all stopped dead in utter awe. It was like standing before the sealed door of Tutankhamun's tomb. The thick panels of the doorway were half covered in moss and had obviously been set into the hillside long ago. The opening itself was covered by a large warped panel, a thick piece of wood that answered for a door. As kids, we were intoxicated with excitement just then, believing we had found the home of some mystical hill-dwelling being. Looking back now, though, a shiver runs down my spine when I think about that covered entryway. It never occurred to us to ask who had placed that great board there, or why the entrance had been blocked, or whether this mysterious site was private property. Why, it didn't even occur to us that someone or something dangerous might lurk inside. All we saw was the potential for adventure. Despite the thrill of discovery, we knew in our guts that we had stumbled upon something truly singular, and we did a good job, most of us, of not getting carried away. That's why, even after we carefully pulled back the board and stared into the night-dark entrance of the bunker, none of us actually went in. None of us except for Jonah, that is. I can still remember the way he stepped into the doorway, squinting into the murk and running his hands against the mossy walls of the interior.
"Who knows what could be in here?"
he said, glancing at each of us in turn. From the entryway, without a flashlight, there was really no telling what awaited us inside. Jonah seemed to sense our reticence and took it upon himself to act as the canary to our coal mine operation.
"I'm going in,"
he told us.
"I'll let you know what I find."
We didn't dissuade him. We didn't warn him of the risks. Didn't even think to postpone his entry until we could get our hands on a flashlight. We all just stood around the mouth of this bunker and watched him slowly pace into the shadows. Curious cowards, the lot of us. It was all concrete. The floors were a little textured, and I could tell that the walls were painted a faint blue. Jonah's Converse shoes drummed out a steady beat as he went in, and the longer we listened, the quieter and more distant those steps became. After a few minutes, his footsteps died away entirely. The sound was eaten up by the inner earth, snuffed out. Some of us, I think, had almost found our nerve and were thinking about venturing in. I remember I called to Jonah feebly from the entrance, something like,
"Hey, how's it going in there? Find anything cool?"
But there was no answer. I was soon joined by a chorus. We began calling out his name, every repetition more fraught with panic than the last. We stretched out the vowels,
"Jonah!"
but still couldn't hear a reply. The air tumbling out of the bunker was moist and scented with rot. The bravest among us would take a couple of steps into the complex, only to suddenly back out, as though the thick darkness within amounted to something tangible and impenetrable. 15-20 minutes on, there was no more excitement in us, only fear. We started to freak out. Our cries became infrequent, and plans were being drafted to either storm in and seek him out, or to pedal back home at double quick speed. Knowing what came next, I'm ashamed to admit I was in the latter camp. We hadn't heard Jonah's step in some time when the silence was suddenly pierced by a scream from deep within the bunker. A nightmarish sound. It came in a single seconds-long burst, so forceful and terror-soaked that it knocked a few of us onto our asses. If you can believe it, though, what came next was much, much scarier for all of us. Silence. When the scream ended, when the cold walls of stone managed to shake off its jarring echo, nothing came to take its place. Some kids in this situation, you know, they like to have a little fun. They'll scream or make a scene just to shock their friends. All of us knew immediately that Jonah's scream hadn't been a put-on, though. He'd never been the kind of kid to play such tricks. It simply wasn't his style. If a nice, cool-headed kid like him was screaming about something, then there was a damn good reason for it. Whatever discussions we'd been engaged in up to that point, we shut our mouths upon hearing that scream and abandoned ship. It was every man for himself. We sprinted through the woods, sought out our bikes by the road, and pedaled like we were competing in the Tour de France. We didn't have cell phones back then, and wouldn't you know it, there weren't any motorists to flag down for help at that moment either. We had to bike all the way home, almost in tears, before we found someone we could tell. And it was a few minutes after that before our parents were able to get the details out of us clearly enough to pass them on to the sheriff. The authorities looked for him. Hell, half the town must have gone looking for him. Volunteers, young and old, filled those woods off and on for the next week. It was a proper search and rescue. Regardless, they never found him. Not a trace of the boy ever turned up. I'm told they brought dogs into the bunker. Lights, cops from the next county over. Nothing. They couldn't turn up one single sign of Jonah, save, of course, for the silver Schwinn still resting in the grass by the road where he had left it. Rewards were set, and for a little while there, the adults in town tried to act optimistic. By fall, though, they'd stopped saying his name altogether. The entire incident was swept under the rug and seldom spoken of. Only one thing changed. Every kid in town was forbidden, absolutely forbidden by parents and cops both, from hanging around in those woods north of town. The bunker, whatever its initial allure, was strictly off limits now. I'm not a child anymore, though. The sheriff who made that decree has long since retired, and after a few decades of studiously avoiding that patch of northern woods, most of the locals have seemingly forgotten the bunker altogether. I never did have the luxury of forgetting, though. I bump into my memories of the place now and then, in dreams and in waking life. It's like an itch you can't reach. When it turns up, you just have to ignore it until it goes away. One day recently, I decided to scratch that itch the only way I knew how. I was in town visiting my family for the first time in ages when I sought out the bunker and explored it for myself. A few days before driving in, I dreamt of the incident and had been haunted by Jonah's scream across the gulf of years, and had gotten it into my head that, being a grown man, I could now do what I had lacked the courage to do as a boy. I knew I wouldn't find anything in there that would give me closure about Jonah's fate. It had been decades, far too long for evidence of that kind to still be kicking around. Still, I wagered that facing my fears and conquering that shadowed haunt of my youth could only be therapeutic. So, hopping on the northbound after lunch with my folks, I came to a screeching halt outside that patch of woods, far denser than I had remembered it, and parked my sedan in the grass, the way I'd once dumped my bike. Though trauma had pretty well imprinted the lay of the land upon my mind, I had a good deal more trouble tracking down the boarded entrance than one might expect. The available landmarks, that is, the curved pipe sticking out of the ground, had been worn almost to stubs by the additional decades of exposure, so I had nothing much to go by. I'd wandered half aimlessly between the trees, investigating the clefts in each hill, the nooks in each shallow valley. The bunker entrance rather snuck up on me. One moment I was bumbling around in the warm woods, growing irritated and entertaining the possibility of throwing in the towel. The next, I happened to slip a little while navigating a wild ravine, and the doorway came into soft focus through the greenery. The way the foliage had parted in a light breeze to reveal the concrete doorway, the warped panel of timber still clinging to the opening, I felt almost as though it had winked at me. Welcome back. It's been a while, hasn't it? 20 years and more separated this encounter with the bunker from my first. How was it then that nothing had changed? I don't mean that in a poetic sense. As I stood there, peeling back the crooked board and staring into the yawning mouth of the underground complex, I was struck by the scene's perfect fidelity to the memory of it. It was as though the clinging weeds and swaying grasses, even the towering box elders overhead, had ceased growing the day Jonah had gone missing. The stony borders of the structure, jutting from the hill as they did, were no more cracked or pitted than they had been the first go-round, despite having weathered a good many more winters. I wondered, then scoffed at the idea that somehow I had stepped back in time by returning there. That seemed the simplest explanation for the bewildering lack of change, anyhow. As kids, we had come unprepared. Now, with a cell phone in my pocket, a flashlight in hand, and a pair of solid boots on, I fancied myself ready for just about anything and went shuffling in, my dull tread echoing against the moss-grown walls the way Jonah's had all those years ago. Though a good deal of the paint had begun to chip off, the walls retained a bluish hue. Early on, I found only solid concrete above me, though a little further in, I spied long successions of piping, much of it reduced to rusted ruin that spanned the length of the initial corridor. That corridor, terminating in leftward and rightward bends that promised access to remoter strata, reeked of dust and earth and damp. It occurred to me then, as I weighed the two avenues available to me, that I didn't really know what I'd gotten myself into. Like Jonah, I was on the cusp of plunging myself into a subterranean maze, and there were no guarantees that I would be able to find my way out again, even with a flashlight. I admit I waffled for a moment, walked a few paces down each of the available paths before simply charging to the right. The enormity of the bunker shocked me. It proved to have a tremendous footprint, and in no way had I expected a succession of passages and rooms that stemmed from the rightward branch. I found chamber after chamber, each of them empty except for the traces of nature that had stolen in. The stems of creeping vines had ingratiated themselves in rare cracks, bearing dark green leaves and rock-hard buds in the absence of sun. The further I ventured in, the more I encountered flooding. Many rooms and hallways were filled with standing water, and it was from these rust-colored pools that the complex's most notable smells emanated. I supposed that the structure, aged and given over to disrepair, was no longer watertight, and that the heavy rains or changes in the water table had wreaked havoc. Mind you, all of this was glimpsed in heavy shadow, shadow burdensome enough to add real weight to the air and slow my step. Natural light had never touched these meandering tunnels, and the darkness that lived in them now clung bat-like to the walls and corners. It was true enough that men had built the bunker, yes, but in its current state, it had become the haunt of other things, with unique energies of their own. But what? There were simply no signs of life anywhere in evidence. I spied not a single insect or small animal in all my time there, and the lack was concerning. Perhaps they all knew something I didn't. Perhaps they had found cause to give the bunker a wide berth, and only I was stupid and arrogant enough to go stamping through. I walked down passages dozens of yards long, all of them made of the same painted concrete, and each taking me further and further from daylight. A handful of chip steps here, a slight declivity in the floors there. I knew myself descending, drawing nearer the earth's bosom with every step, and the lower I got, the more prodigious the flooding became. Rooms to the right and left of me, once intended to house nervous doomsday preppers, or really who could say what, were half inundated. Well into my journey, I discovered the grated fixtures in some of these rooms, titanic metal objects that the invasive flow had warped beyond recognition. It was the drippage of these that lent the standing water its reddish color and added to the air that especially nauseating tang of oxidation. How had Jonah navigated these lengthy passages without a light? I was tempted to put out my flashlight for a moment so that I might acquaint myself with the grade of darkness he had been forced to grapple with in his wanderings. Pausing in a relatively dry span of corridor, I shut my eyes and found I could imagine it plenty well. His shaky hands against the flaking walls, his feet pattering uncertainly against the concrete and through the occasional standing pool. The sounds of every pace and breath rebounding against the earth and crowding back in on them, just as my own did. What had begun as an exciting journey into the unknown had quickly transformed into a nightmare. There had likely come a time when, having gone quite deep into the labyrinth, he had walked his fill and wished to return to the entrance, only to find himself marooned in the damp shadows. Always calm and even keeled, Jonah would not have made a fuss. No, he would not have called out for help or given the rest of us any notice of his troubles. Instead, with a sturdy resolve, he would have done everything in his power to slowly retrace his steps and find his way out. And in the process, he would only have become more hopelessly lost. He never did make his way out, of course. And when the powers of the above-ground world came looking, they failed to find the scrap of the boy.
So,
I asked myself aloud,
what happened then?
Frightened and confused, Jonah had eventually wandered into mortal trouble. In the utter blackness of the complex, he could not have possibly known what he was up against, could not have relied on his eyes. And yet, whatever had compelled him to unleash that monstrous scream, it had communicated itself to him without recourse to sight. But there was nothing in the bunker to fear, nothing that I could see anyhow. The going was thoroughly unpleasant, and in my carelessness I made many opportunities for rude shocks and stoked my own jumpiness. The deep halls were empty, though. I was alone in them. And never once did I doubt that fact as I trudged. At least, not until I reached the bunker's rightmost extremity. I had branched off to the right, and though I was astonished at the breadth of the construction, the bunker was not, in fact, endless. I came with little fanfare to a dead end. Narrow doorways appeared to both sides of me, but these would take me no deeper into the earth. Instead, they appeared to lead only into rooms of the aforementioned kind. Flooded, filthy, unremarkable spaces the likes of which I had seen enough of. I pitched a glance into each one of these and finding nothing of interest, the entire errand seemed to lose its savor. I had now gotten my fill of adventuring, and honestly felt a bit embarrassed at the whole episode. There were finer things for a man of my years to get up to than this. I'd set out in search of catharsis, but would leave having found only the stench that now clung to my t-shirt and jeans. I was turning around, mentally mapping my return to the exit, when I heard something from one of those two back rooms. It was wholly unexpected, and it stopped me in my tracks. My ears were in something of a fog. The constant echoes thrust upon them by the setting had given them a lot to chew on, so at first I thought they were mistaken. Grinding to a halt and keeping my breath locked in my chest, however, I soon realized that the sound of splashing had been genuine. From the room on the left, I heard the sound of something slipping into the water. It had not been a hard or conspicuous sound. Rather, it had seemed to me the result of a smooth and practiced movement, a stealthy maneuver, the sound of a crocodile submerging in silent pursuit of its prey was the nearest comparison I could imagine as I stood listening, and so naturally, I backtracked. How strange, thought I. Perhaps I wasn't so alone in these tunnels after all. A mouse or raccoon, an otter or other creature was sharing the bunker with me and had been spooked into the stand and pull by the sound of my advance. When I returned to the doorway of the room on the left and shone my light in, I found the water disturbed by a series of ripples in a long shimmering wake. I did not discover an otter there, however, nor a raccoon, a rat, or a crocodile. Even the last would have been far preferable to the thing I did find. I watched as something came floating briskly through the water. Someone. Gliding on his back, I saw that it was a boy of roughly 12. His name was summoned at once to my lips. Years and years ago, I'd shouted that same name into this shadowed bunker. His swollen body, wrapped in gray and bulging flesh, was draped in torn jeans and a muddied flannel shirt, and his sandy hair clung to the water's surface like oil. His eyes, greenish yellow, were open. More than that, they were fixed on me. Jonah, or rather his corpse, was not merely floating along. With a jerk of his dead limbs, he snapped himself through the water like a great eel and flopped noisily against the floor, mere feet from the doorway. There was a rubbery scrambling. Bloated hands pawed against the concrete as he stood and came lurching toward the hall. My earlier plans were abandoned. Where I had been plotting to carefully retrace my steps and find my way out calmly, I now went barreling down the corridor with the flashlight locked in my fist and my boots thumping out a drum solo. In the offbeats, I could hear his sodden feet squelching in pursuit. A plaintive cry rose up to my back. A voice marred by groaning and disuse, but still vaguely familiar to my ear. Jonah? I gasped, pausing around the next bend and steadying my light on the path ahead. Jonah, is that really you?
Please,
continued my pursuer.
Please, wait for me. The light. I haven't seen the light in so long.
I wasn't in the right headspace for catching up, but I hurled a question into the darkness in spite of myself.
Jonah, what happened to you?
The corpse's clopping tread was very close now. and so was the groaning voice.
I got lost. I couldn't see. I've been looking for a way out, but it's too dark. The light. Please, don't take away the light. Please wait for me and help me find my way out.
I wanted nothing to do with the hideous thing creeping through the passage behind me. And yet I could not bear the thought of sprinting out and leaving him to howl and weep in the darkness that had kept him prisoner these 20 plus years. I staggered a little way ahead, but not so far that Jonah would lose sight of my light.
There,
I continued.
Can you see the light?
Yes,
came the reply.
Good,
said I.
Just keep an eye on it, all right? Follow it, and I'll lead you out of here.
I did not really understand what I was promising, and in the back of my mind, I was reasonably sure that I was hallucinating. What did I expect to do upon reaching the exit with this nightmarish pal in tow? The whole spectacle was absurd enough to make me want to laugh, but the illness stewing in my throat ensured I didn't. I slowed my pace a touch and held the light high so that my old friend could hone in on it like a moth. Together, we walked past innumerable doorways and down many halls in search of the exit. All the while, racked with pity and nagged by fear, I listened for his tread behind mine. I kept a safe distance, yet never once allowed his footfalls to vanish from my hearing. I had done that once. I had stood at the threshold with the other kids, listening as his steps died out. I would not do that to him again, however. Eventually, the rounding of a corner reintroduced me to the main stretch, that is, the initial corridor whose other end was aglow with soothing daylight. Still several paces behind, Jonah took note of the exit, and I heard him sigh with great relief. I put down my flashlight, and together the two of us walked the rest of the way out and strove toward the sun. We had come very near the exit. I was standing mere feet from the doorway and could feel the warmth of day on my skin. I turned and found Jonah close behind. Though much to my relief, his appearance had reverted to something more familiar. He appeared at my side as a healthy boy of 12, the way he had looked the day we cycled out to the woods. His smile was broad, his clothes stained only with the grime of boyish recreation. In a word, he was whole again. The two of us stood for a time in the doorway, peering out into the afternoon and savoring the breeze. After a while, I found the courage to ask him something. Something that I and everyone else had long wondered about.
That day, Jonah, when you first went inside.
I glanced back at the long stretch of dark behind us.
What happened?
I started to explore,
he replied. The recollection quickly chased away his smile.
I went down the path on the left, and I wandered for quite a while. That's when something found me in there.
Something found you?
I asked.
Down the left-hand path, you say? What was it?
In search of the right words, my friend had been staring silently into the field. Suddenly he threw a glance over his shoulder, a narrow one, and that was when I heard it. The scurrying. Something was bolting hard and fast out of the darkness. Flesh rasped energetically against concrete. Whether against the floor, walls, or ceiling, I couldn't guess, before the buildup of sound in the passage overwhelmed my senses and inspired visions of numberless grasping limbs. It seemed the sound of 100 hands, all of them straining to hurl something, some presence through the shadows. Whatever moved did not intend to reveal itself. It stopped some distance from the exit, mindful of the daylight. While its bulk remained heaped in shadow, wholly obscure, the thing that it extended toward us, a long black strand, like a wiry bristle, did not evade my sight. The wiry bristle came shooting out of the depths, and when it touched Jonah's body, I watched him jerk, his eyes widening violently. Our gazes together met just above his navel, where the tip of that wiry line had buried itself. Gore trickled down its length. The black wire remained taut while roaming around in his abdomen. Once it had anchored itself in his organs, he was tugged back into the shadows like a hooked fish. I heard Jonah flop against the floor, heard him writhe as he was dragged hastily into the bunker. Then came the scream. The same terrible scream I'd heard all those years ago, issuing from the same place. And afterward, just like before, the same devilish silence asserted itself. This time, though, I didn't run straight for town. I hobbled out of the bunker and dropped onto the ground, staring into the doorway. Initially, I stared in disbelief, but the longer I pressed against the darkness of the corridor with my gaze, the more certain I became that I had locked eyes with something unseeable within it. That was when I finally got up and ran. I'm still convinced it was all a bad dream. Fumes from some underground gas leak, bad air. I haven't told anyone about it because I know they'll have me committed. And for that matter, I haven't been back home since. I've had to put off my folks several times, declining their offers of get-togethers and meals. They think I'm too much of a city boy now to come visit them, and I'm happy enough to let them believe what they like, if it means keeping clear of the woods up north. The bunker is still out there, and without meaning to, I've probably baked enough identifying info into this write-up for you to dig up its precise location and visit it for yourself. Of course, I'd advise against doing that. No good will come of it. I learned the hard way that sometimes the best method of dealing with a traumatic memory is just to leave it alone. So much for exposure therapy. But if you insist on going anyway, make sure to prepare. You'll need a good light, solid footwear. Don't go at night either. You'll thank me later. Oh, and another thing. Keep to the right. I can't recommend the left-hand path. And that was It Waits Along the Left-Hand Path by Ambrose Ibsen. Nowadays, kids just stay at home and play Roblox. I tell you, no sense of adventure. A little about the author. Once upon a time, a young Ambrose Ibsen discovered a collection of ghost stories on his father's bookshelf and was never the same again. Apart from horror fiction, he enjoys good coffee brewed strong. Ambrose has written nearly 50 novels and short story collections. So if you like what you've heard, there's plenty more where that came from. Again, this story is from his book, What Gathers at Dusk, which is available on Velox Books and Audible.com. Hey, thanks, Ambrose.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
Well, I guess this is where we part ways, at least till next week. A special thanks to listener Brandon Rapier for his nice review on our book, The Split Tail Files, on Amazon. He says, if you're looking for a good laugh, this book is a great place to start. Looking anywhere else would be downright undignified. And we appreciate it very much, Brandon. And stay tuned for the audiobook coming soon. Just got to redo a few of the stories with better audio. We started those a long time ago when we were pretty green at this shit. In the meantime, grab a drink for the road, friend. May the wind be at your back, and may the road rise up to meet you. We'll see y'all next week. But until then, go fuck yourselves. Good night, my friends.